So, you know, we're here in a spiritual environment and we're practicing. Some of us are oriented towards change for spiritual reasons. Some may be here, they're interested in change in some very, very material aspects of their lives. In Buddhism in general, certainly we have relationships. We have relationships with our teachers, with our colleagues. Sometimes those might be I-Thou relationships, hopefully. Sometimes those are. There is a state of non-dual realization that Buber, I don't think exactly accounts for. But non-dual realization means you don't have a hard sense of I, you don't have a hard sense of other. You just are being. And it certainly seems that much of what he writes about in I-Thou would be very, very similar to what we could talk about in non-dual realization. So one of the things that I think we all should think about when we're thinking about change is that, you know, our culture actually glorifies autonomy. We just do. And, you know, if you read anthropologists, and I've got a quote in my book, if you want to chase it down, by Clifford Geertz, we really have this strange notion of sort of the individual against the world, the individual against the physical universe, against the social universe, against all odds, and it's the individual who's doing this. And historically, in terms of human culture, this is a kind of bizarre exception. Most cultures do not hold autonomy, individuality, singularity with that much excitement. It's just not where most cultures have been at. But we have evolved into this. Again, Taylor's book on Sources of the Self is great in this. But slowly, slowly, we in the West have evolved into this position of holding on to this autonomous, separate, distinct individual against nature, this I-it person, as like a summum bonum, like the highest good. And if people are thinking of changing, often where they get really deeply stuck, as far as I'm aware, is they get very much into an I-it relationship with themselves. And they're trying to relate to themselves as an it. There are several important phenomena in life that people wish to change, like sleep, like laughter, like relaxation, which aren't necessarily willfully creatable. So if you come to these things with this idea, like, I can make anything happen, you're screwed. It ain't going to happen. And a lot of folks in our culture think they can make anything happen. You know, somebody presents in my case many, many years ago in my case history, working 80 hours, 90 hours for one of the large firms, stressed out of their minds. This comes in, he wants to relax, you know, wants to feel less stress. But he wants to continue the lifestyle he's in. I can't do anything with that. I mean, it's not like I'm going to give you one more task to do to sort of like tweak it around so you can work 80 hours, not sleep, not have any relationships, not do anything for your health. And, you know, you just do 5 more minutes of something and you'll be relaxed. That's thinking like I-it. You got all the power in the world. So I think that it's very, very important for anybody who's contemplating change to see that one of the things that I think Prochaska is really saying is that, you know, there's a lot of time and a lot of support that you need to bring to a process of change. That support might include knowledge, it might mean social institutions, it might mean personal help, it might mean friends, it might mean relationships, and it also might mean time. You know, he has all sorts of interesting data about, you know, how many people, what, most of the people who vowed to stop smoking, it took 5 New Years before they got there. Who allows themselves 5 years when they're undertaking a process of change? And a lot of people in our culture will think, well, I'm going to do X religiously. I'm just going to do it alone. And, you know, gung-ho, they start something. They've got no friends. They've got no teachers. They've got no community. They've got no books. I think there's a song like this. You can't do that. You know, occasionally one person out of a billion, you know, climbs Mount Everest blind alone. Okay, so there are people like that. There are people like that. We may not even know any, but statistically, there are a couple of really odd nuts that do things like that. Great. But most of us are not like that. We need a lot of time and a lot of support. But I also want to add that, you know, I think, especially as a spiritual center and an organization, that we want to consider that when we're thinking of change, that really there is probably a kind of non-instrumental basis that supports change. You know, whether that's an I-thou state or a non-dual state or some kind of mindfulness state or a peaceful state or a loving state, state of presence, kindness, processes that emphasize support of one another, mutual support. These are all contextual for allowing change to come forth, to be initiated, and then to be supported and to move forward. As opposed to hyper-autonomy, exaggerated, grandiose will, power, focus on goals, targets, and accomplishment. There is obviously room and place in this world for Marines charging up a hill, and occasionally a soul Marine charging up a hill. There are places for that. As an approach to personal change and life change, I want to suggest, especially if you start noticing that you keep sort of getting a third of the way up a hill and then you fall back down, that there may be some contextual, non-instrumental supports that might be very, very important to you that you're not bringing into your life. And one more general thing that I would say is that, you know, when we think about change, it's a really slippery slope for the following reason. If I say I want to lose 20 pounds, it's very, very easy for me to then think, well, this me who, let's say, it's not true, but let's say I weigh 200 pounds and I want to lose 20 to go to 180. A lot of people get into a frame of mind of, I hate my 200-pound self. I hate that I'm 200 pounds and I hate that I'm my 200-pound self. I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. That's kind of dangerous, I think. I don't think, at least for us in the West, that as a long-term strategy, it is advisable to be walking around thinking that you hate yourself and that's a motivation for change and that's going to be really effective. And somewhere in the middle of Prochaska's book, he cites some research that seems to support that particular position. But it creeps in. And whether it's something as simple as, I'd like to meditate 5 minutes a day, that's a new self. It's very, very easy to slip into, and the fact that I don't means I'm a crumbum. I'm less good. And I know Jane over there, she's meditating a half hour a day. I sort of hate Jane. I wish I knew how she did it. I can't tell anybody I hate Jane, because that's certainly not spiritually correct attitude. And I don't have a clue how she meditates a half hour a day. I can't even manage 5 minutes a day. Where the heck can she get a half hour? And I can't get 5 minutes. How would I do 5 minutes? I hate myself. I feel shame. I'm a terrible person. Many, many of us have swum in those waters. But it's another version of, I wish all these people would go away and leave me alone so I can meditate on compassion. I hate them. There's something wrong with that picture. And so, you know, I can't deal with every situation generically here, sitting up here, but certainly talking to Ann and me and talking to other members of the community or really reflecting on yourself, we need to be kind to ourselves. And if we're doing things where we feel it's painful to ourselves, we need to really reflect on that carefully. There's a kink in the armor of my spiritual life. 'Tis not good. It's very, very important. So that's sort of a large frame in terms of any changes we're going to be doing. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. Be supportive of yourself. Be supportive of others.